From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's edition of Fresh Air, I speak with Reverend Jerry Falwell. He recently stepped down as president of the Moral Majority and resigned as chairman of the PTL Club, which he took over in the wake of the Jim Baker scandal. Falwell has just written an autobiography. Also today, I talk with Don Opper. He wrote the screenplay for the new film Slam Dance, directed by Wayne Wang. Opper also plays a thug in the film. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a 3-record set of saxophonist Ike Quebec's Jazz 45s. And television critic David Bianculli examines the Morton Downey Jr. Show, a talk show with a host who abuses both his guests and his audience. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. It's been a year filled with sudden changes for my guest, Reverend Jerry Falwell. Through his group, The Moral Majority, Falwell forged the religious right into an organized political force. Earlier this month, Falwell stepped down from The Moral Majority. He said he was leaving politics to get back to basics, preaching and evangelizing, and to devote his energy to his television show, The Old Time Gospel Hour, to his Thomas Road Baptist Church, Liberty Baptist College, and other related projects. Falwell's withdrawal from the Moral Majority came on the heels of his resignation from the PTL Club. He assumed leadership of the PTL television ministry after its head, Jim Baker, admitted to an extramarital sexual encounter he had with Jessica Hahn and had paid her hush money. This scandal sent shockwaves throughout the electronic churches, and television ministers are still assessing the damage. These recent changes in Falwell's life coincide with the publication of his autobiography, Strength for the Journey, just published by Simon & Schuster. Jerry Falwell, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you, Terry.
Stepping down from the Moral Majority, in a way, completes a full cycle for you. Back in 1965, you made
a speech.
You preached a sermon, thank you, saying that you didn't think politics belonged in the pulpit. But after abortion was legalized, you decided to get into politics and eventually form the Moral Majority, and now you've withdrawn from politics again. What were your reasons for it?
Well, after 8 years of organizing the religious right, registering several million persons to vote, we've been able also to train a lot of leadership. Many are pastors, many are not. And whereas one person was needed in 1979, perhaps, the early 80s, I think that, and I made this clear over a year ago, that I was moving in this direction, that my involvement in the presidency of that organization, day-to-day administrative responsibilities, traveling a couple hundred thousand miles annually, lobbying and stumping for candidates like Ronald Reagan, etc., really needed to come to an end because I am first and foremost a pastor, a preacher of the gospel of Jesus Christ. I am chancellor of Liberty University and pastor of Thomas Road Baptist Church, and with a new president in place and the Moral Majority stronger than ever, it was an excellent time for me to step aside, and I have done it.
I figure, in a way, you probably didn't plan on this because it was only last year that you organized the Liberty Federation, which was an umbrella group for you to expand into international issues.
January of 86, in addition to Moral Majority, we did form the Liberty Federation, right, with a broader agenda than, more or less, the Reagan agenda. And both organizations are well-staffed with offices in Washington and Lynchburg, Virginia. I announced last fall, October 86, that I would be pulling away from active day-to-day involvement, and we waited a year till the fiscal year was over, August 31, just passed, and saw that the revenues were up, not down, that it wasn't dependent on Jerry Falwell, as once it might have been. And we feel very good about what has been done, but we feel much better about getting back to the pulpit.
I think a lot of Americans have seen the religious right as a unanimous group, people who agree on all of the issues, who agree on who the candidates should be. And there's recently been some fragmentation within that group. I'm thinking, for instance, that you supported George Bush for the presidency.
I do.
And Pat Robertson, who is one of the best known of the television ministers, is
a candidate.
A candidate himself, right. And I'm sure he would have preferred that you supported him.
And he's a friend, and there are four good friends of mine who are Republican candidates. Bob Dole is an excellent candidate, as is Jack Kemp. Probably Jack Kemp would be, along with Pat Robertson, would enjoy a closer kinship with the religious right. And I like all four of them, and you'd find you're right. You'd find that the religious right today, at this point, would be divided among those four candidates because, number one, of their philosophies, each of them, and number two, the Republican platform.
Do you think that Pat Robertson's candidacy has, in a way, caused a crisis for the politicized evangelical community? Because now they have to choose between the Republican Party candidates or Pat Robertson?
I think it'll be more of a maturing thing than a damaging thing. I think that Pat Robertson will be very good for the Republican Party after the convention. After the nominee is in place, he will do for the Republicans what I think Jesse Jackson has done and is doing for the Democrats. He will bring in a different universe, a new universe, and he will, in my opinion, find himself supporting very aggressively whoever that nominee is.
Nevertheless, do you think that now the Republican Party feels betrayed by Pat Robertson and
probably.
His supporters because instead
yes,
of
probably.
Giving the moral majority support?
And I personally, and as a friend of Pat, I can say this without it sounding wrong. My druthers are that no ordained minister would run for public office. I thought Mr. Edgar would have been better to remain as a Methodist minister. I thought Father Drinan would have been best in the priesthood. Jesse Jackson, Pat Robertson. It's an issue of whether they can. They certainly have the right to do it. But I personally think you lose something when you run for office. I think you lose your vantage point of unbiased positions on issues and without ulterior motives. My druthers are, I wish they had not run. I think it does create a little problem for us on the right, and I'm sure Pat knows that.
Did it diminish your power base in a way since there? You know, you probably lost some of your support, the people who were supporting Pat Robertson.
I don't think so. It's a different breed. The person who is interested in and supports a religious ministry and the person who supports a political candidate are almost two different animals entirely. And I have not noticed any crossover either way.
My guest is Reverend Jerry Falwell, who has just written an autobiography titled Strength for the Journey. I know that you're very proud of the role that you and your group, the Moral Majority, played in the electing of Ronald Reagan to the presidency. And I'd just be interested in briefly in hearing your reaction to the Iran-Contra scandal and the revelations that were brought by the congressional committee that investigated it.
Well, obviously, this is a nation of laws, not emotions and feelings and people. And while I'm a very strong supporter of Ronald Reagan, and I very much like Colonel North and Admiral Poindexter, and I like their commitment to the country. Obviously, they had a dilemma, a Congress that did not want to support the president's policy in Central America and their own desire to support the president's policy. And obviously, they went against the will of the Congress, and that has been shown. And I think that cases have been made that laws have been broken, or at least they will certainly be made. I'm also reading today that there will be some pardons, presidential pardons in the making. I don't know that. I just read it like anyone else. It is a dilemma. I think while I am very supportive of the president's policy, I think the president was embarrassed, and there are some who would feel that he was involved. I do not. I would take the position that although perhaps he should have known, I would take the position that he did not know, and I would exonerate him of any wrongdoing, and I think that's what the congressional report did in fact say. Bad judgment call, but not a breaking of the law. I think it did hurt him. I have a strong feeling about the Congress not doing what they should do, but that does not permit the abrogation of the law.
The committee suggested that he was guilty of letting this happen in his administration, even if he didn't know that it was happening, that he it's his duty to make sure that all constitutional laws are
And I think all the surveys show that's where the American people are.
Did you lose any faith in the president through these revelations?
No, not at all. I was sorry to see Ed Meese and Jim Baker leave the troika that in the first term were at the president's right hand every moment. I certainly think Mr. Reagan and now Howard Baker are fine men. But I somehow felt that James Baker and Ed Meese, particularly those two, were constantly looking out for the president's well-being. And I don't think they would have allowed this bungling to have occurred had they been there.
Reverend Jerry Falwell is my guest. We were just talking about how the Pat Robertson campaign is affecting the power of the religious right. What about the PTL scandal? Do you think that that has tainted the credibility of other leaders in the religious right? Do you think that the after effects, that the shock waves from that scandal is tainting
three things people? In yeah. the last the last 24 months, about three things I think have hurt most in the evangelical camp. One, the growing awareness that Pat Robertson would probably run for the presidency. There are many evangelicals like myself who have a deep love for Pat Robertson and appreciation for him and his ability and his prowess and his background, etc., who would have preferred he did not run. And I think there are many out there who feel very strongly, so strongly, that they won't financially support a ministry because of that. Secondly, the Oral Roberts fundraising death wish, death threat thing I thought was very debilitating to credibility. And then, of course, the Jim Baker sex and money scandal at PTL. I've used the term Watergate. It has sort of a Watergate effect. It's a paralyzing effect right now because everything that the Elmer Gantry story in fiction was, this is better if you're a movie producer than that because it has all that intrigue, and unfortunately, it's so. I watched Ted Koppel on Nightline recently with Mr. Baker, The Last Encounter, 1 hour of brutality. And Ted Koppel is not given to brutality. He is a very objective journalist, but I could see him in his eyes and his voice a total disgust because his last question after all of the 1 hour of painful interrogation, his last question was, Mr. Baker, what kind of role model do you think you have been for Christianity? Powerful question. And with that, he went off the air. That is how people are thinking across this country and are wondering, is anybody honest? What about Billy Graham? Maybe he's a fraud. Maybe Falwell's a fraud. Maybe Charles Stanley. Maybe my pastor. Maybe where I go to church, I'd better check. And just that little question mark has caused revenues to be down for organizations like the Salvation Army. What possible connection? And such ministers right across the nation. It is a national paralysis of giving and trust, and I think we've got 2 or 3 years of that to endure before it's history.
You became involved in the future of PTL because when Jim Baker stepped down, you took over the ministry, and then you eventually resigned from PTL. Now, you had heard rumors right before the story actually broke that Jim Baker was involved in this sex scandal. You had a brief meeting with him in a hotel room before the story broke.
First and only ever with him.
Your first in-person
meeting I've ever had with him, and the only one.
Now, what did he tell you at the meeting?
He told me, when I asked him about the rumors, yes, 7 years ago, an event did occur. He called it an encounter. He said that John Wesley Fletcher, a fellow evangelist and co-worker of his, had brought his former babysitter from New York to Florida to meet him during a time when his wife, Tammy Faye, had left him and was threatening never to come back. He said, I was just trying to make her jealous. I did not have sex with Jessica. If anything, she tried to rape me, but I was impotent. That was what he said. When I asked, did you use PTL funds for hush money? He said, I did not. I used my own funds. And later he advised me that he felt the Assemblies of God were going to defrock him, the denomination, and they did, and that there was a 2-year restoration period in which he could be reaccepted into the Pentecostal ministry there. After 6 hours, and he had already asked me to become the chairman, and by the way, he alone could not do that. His full board met the next night unanimously, choosing a new board now of 10 persons, and they accordingly resigned. A blue ribbon panel that was put together very quickly. He asked me as I was about to leave Palm Springs, the hotel, do you think, Jerry, I could ever come back maybe in a year, 2 years, to PTL? And I remembered very emphatically saying to him, Jim, if what you've told me is true, and also if you are restored to the pastorate, the ministry, by the Assemblies of God, and if the people want you at PTL, I would never stand in your way. Our commitment was to a one-year tenure there. We had our board decided we will give it 1 year. We will not be paid. We will do the best we can. Win or lose, we walk in 1 year. That would have been next March. We only made 6.5 months. And when it became obvious to us that the court was leaning towards some pro-Baker people on the board, and the door was not totally slammed to the return of Mr. Baker. We later learned in weeks that followed so many things that told us as a board we not only must restore the ministry, but guarantee Mr. Baker does not return. When we learned that we could not be assured of that latter goal, we quietly walked out.
On one level, I was almost surprised when you accepted the chairmanship of PTO.
So was my wife.
Well, you are such a different kind of preacher and leader than Jim Baker is. For instance, first of all, you're from different religious denominations. Mm-hmm. And second of all, just in terms of your television ministries, mm-hmm. you're totally opposite. You have a very—
We're teaching, preaching, education. There are things in entertainment and fun and Hollywood.
Well, yeah, your service is basically taped in your church, and it's a very large church. Mm-hmm. The Jim and Tammy Baker show was much more showbiz, much more entertainment-oriented. And I wonder why you wanted to get involved in it.
Really only one reason. The ministry, a mammoth one, although totally different than anything Billy Graham, a Jerry Falwell, a Charles Stanley, a Jim Kennedy might be involved in, is, in the eye of the general public, one member of a monolithic community. That's not true, but that is the perception. And if it were allowed to collapse and hundreds of millions of dollars lost and people hurt, there was no way it could not create a terrific negative backwash on everybody, which in fact has happened. We didn't know, of course, the depth of the problems and the depravity of the situation. We probably would not have taken it had we known that. But knowing what we knew, we felt we could conserve the ministry and we could perhaps put it in good hands and leave there. And everybody would say, well, the Christian family had a problem. They solved their own problem. They met their obligations. And I guess you'd say a controlled crash landing is what we hoped to have. That did not occur. And there has been a very, very bad fallout that will be longstanding.
Well, I want to talk to you about that fallout, but first we're going to take a short break. My guest is Reverend Jerry Falwell, who recently stepped down as the president of the Moral Majority and as the chair of PTL. He's written an autobiography which is titled Strength for the Journey. We'll talk more after the short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest is Reverend Jerry Falwell. Now, right before our break, you were talking about the fallout from the PTL mm-hmm. scandal. I'd like to know specifically what the fallout has been in your ministry. You rely on the public for fundraising money, and you also get so much in the way of mail and phone calls that I bet you have some pretty good ways of registering if there's been any lack of faith in the television ministry.
A national ministry, and there are probably 6 or 8 of them, is much like a national corporation as far as feeling national pulse. The first and by far the most important fallout has been the testimonial and the credibility problem. A lot of people have had their personal faith damaged. I think of young people, teenagers. I think of a lot of persons who, as skeptics, have been approaching Christianity very cautiously but carefully, moving towards Christianity. Have been set back light years. I meet them everywhere who are saying, I'll never go to church again, or I would never help any Christian ministry again. That's been the most important thing. Secondly, economically, as best I can tell, and I share notes with other ministers across the country and major churches, there's been about a 20% softness in support. That is very significant, meaning if of all the churches in this country, and I don't know what I think it's like $80 billion given a year to charities, universities, churches, ministries, $80 billion. 20% of that, or one-fifth of that, is $16 billion. I think when the year's history and someone has taken the time to compute what has happened, it will be about that. I would say that this has hurt the universities, the churches, the schools, the various mercy ministries to hurting people out there. I think the credibility thing has so financially damaged ministries that we will be probably 5 years getting over it. In our own ministry, we're just a minuscule part of it with a $100 million annual budget, which is hardly something to gauge the multi-billion dollar problem. But in our own ministry, we have in about 5 months lost about $5 million from that area, meaning we had to quickly adjust to it. And just like you in National Public Radio, if you don't get it, you just got to stop doing some things. And it just frankly has hurt us. And I haven't met anyone that it has not hurt.
There is very little in the way of accountability for television ministers now. And you yourself in your autobiography write that traditionally TV ministers don't answer to anyone. They don't – I'm talking about the fundamentalist ministers. They don't have a larger denomination frequently that they're answering to. And they answer to their board, but the people on their board are frequently loyalists, loyal to the head of the TV ministry. So consequently, there's very little in the way of accountability or of checks and balances or anything like that. You must be very concerned about this now. Do you have any suggestions? Are you and your colleagues trying to figure out ways of holding people accountable so that their scandals no longer will impact on your ministries?
Without a doubt. The Southern Baptist Convention, for example, the largest Protestant denomination, is a group of 34,000 really independent churches. Then you have many other denominations in the country and fellowships of churches. Probably a third of the churches in America have no responsibility to a hierarchy. That is not all bad. In many cases, that is good. But in this area, it has been a factor. Then you go beyond that to the television and radio ministries, most of which are evangelical and fundamentalist. The best-known ones, as I've mentioned, Billy Graham, Jerry Falwell, Pat Robertson, Jimmy Swaggart, Charles Stanley. But there are hundreds of lesser-known ones whose names you might not know, but who are out there and doing quite a work. Most of them belong, 75%, to the national religious broadcasters. And 1 year ago, before PTL, the board of directors, of which I am a member, Dr. Ben Armstrong, our executive director, decided we need, inside this organization, a better business bureau-type organization and make it mandatory for membership in NRB. Well, we got some flack on that, as a matter of fact, we had a problem getting a majority vote. One reason is the First Amendment. Who's the government to be telling us what we can and cannot do? On the other side was the desire for openness, accountability, and when PTL exploded in late March, it was, on the positive side, the catalyst we needed to press on with this new organization. It's called EFICOM, EFICOM, Ethics and Financial Integrity Commission. The board now has approved it by an overwhelming majority, over two-thirds vote. It's a large board, about 90 members. And this January, the entire rank-and-file membership will vote on it. My opinion, a two-thirds, maybe three-fourths vote will pass. At that time, in order to be a member of NRB, now, admittedly, you don't have to be a member of NRB, but if you belong to National Religious Broadcasters, which is a very credible and 40-year-old organization, automatically you must meet the standards of EFICOM. And that is like the ABA for the lawyers and AMA for the doctors, a self-policing kind of thing. It does not in any way guard against fraud. It probably would not have prevented PTL from occurring. It probably, you know, it won't prevent a person who is given to dishonesty from doing something. Only the authorities can stop that. But it will be a seal, a good housekeeping kind of seal to the general public that if a person does not belong to NRB without any blackballing, it says something to the donor. Maybe he doesn't want to be accountable.
I'm sure that you've had to really reassess your life and your goals in the light of resigning from the moral majority, in the light of the PTL scandal. It had been one of your goals to really influence the politics of our nation. You've withdrawn from being active in the political arena now. What about your concerns about the social and political agenda in America? Are you going to still preach those issues from the pulpit?
Yes, I will not. My removal from the presidency and my placement of Dr. Jerry Nims as the new president simply means three things. One, day-to-day administrative duties are no longer mine. Two, I will not be traveling a couple hundred thousand miles a year, most of the time devoted to political lobbying and stumping for candidates like Ronald Reagan, etc. And three, I will not be in Washington half the time attempting to bring about the goals and ideals that have been mine. I've been registering millions of voters and training thousands of pastors and leaders. Others will be doing it. The organization is stronger than ever. But my thing will be from henceforth, as chairman of the board, I will certainly have something to do with policy. I will certainly be speaking on the issues. George Bush asked me the day after I resigned, "What does this mean?" I said, "Well, it just means that I won't be out there involved. I'm still for you. I still will speak on behalf of you. I believe in you. But I'll not make one speech or make one trip, as I did for Mr. Reagan, to carry that forth." And he understands that. But it's I'm 54 years old. I'm a husband and a daddy of three kids and who are growing out fast, and pastor of 22,000 church members and a chancellor of Liberty University with 8,000 students. That's where I want to spend the rest of my life.
Did you feel at all used by the politicians who you supported, that they wanted you for the votes that you could get but didn't necessarily wholeheartedly endorse your full social and political agenda?
No, I didn't, because I went in with my eyes wide open. I'm fully aware that the Republican platform, which we helped carve, was a necessary thing for some of the gentlemen who don't necessarily agree to it. Ronald Reagan is not one of them. But there are a lot of Republicans who consider the economic conservatives and the political conservatives and the religious conservatives a necessary but tenuous coalition for election to a national office. I'm not disillusioned by thinking that everybody in the Republican Party agrees with our philosophy. I know they can't win without us, and I know that they know that. And so I know that whoever the Republican candidate is come next August, that person will be knocking on the door of all these people because they need to keep the Reagan coalition together. I think one thing we have learned, of course, I think we've matured as the black church in the 50s, in the civil rights movement, was first an anathema and now a part of the fabric. We are likewise becoming a part of the fabric, and I think that we'll be stronger in 88 than we were in 84 or in 80.
We only have a couple of seconds left, but that means that you think that in spite of everything that's happened to the religious right this year, that you think that it hasn't been, lost its strength.
No, November 88, more persons will vote for, in my opinion, the Republican candidate, whomever it is, than voted for Reagan.
We're out of time. I want to thank you very much for talking with us. My guest has been Reverend Jerry Falwell, who recently stepped down as president of the Moral Majority and as the head of the PTL Club. He's just written a autobiography. It's titled Strength for the Journey, and it's just been published by Simon & Schuster. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with Charles Rosenberg. His new book is titled The Care of Strangers, The Rise of America's Hospital System, and it shows how the development of our hospitals has been an expression of our country's economics, technology, and social values. I hope you can join us.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by a major grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and a grant from Fisher's World Travel Guides. Fisher's World Guidebooks, featuring the removable travel planner designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, I talk with actor and screenwriter Don Opper. He hoped to star as the new wave cartoonist in his new film Slam Dance, but instead he got to play a thug. Wayne Wang directed the film. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a new collection of Blue Note Jazz 45s featuring tenor saxophonist Ike Quebec. And television critic David Bianculli reviews the Morton Downey Jr. Show, one superstation's answer to shock radio. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Mark Boardman in Washington. For the second time in 3 days, Cuban detainees have rioted at a federal detention center. The scene today, the Atlanta prison, where hundreds of Cubans burned buildings and took hostages. Assistant Warden Mike Caltabiano says the incident started when some of the prisoners tried to escape.
An unknown number of Cuban detainees started a disturbance in the food service and industries area. That's our factory area. It's rapidly spread to other areas of the institution. We have some hostages. We don't know how many. We do have some injuries on both. We don't know how many or the particulars.
On both?
On both sides, detainees as well as staff.
Federal officials in Atlanta are negotiating with the Cubans. Meanwhile, in Oakdale, Louisiana, nearly 1,000 Cuban prisoners are still holding more than 20 guards hostage. Cubans at that facility went on a rampage Saturday. They say they'll kill the hostages if a rescue is attempted. In Texas, authorities are still looking for 6 Cubans who broke out of jail yesterday. 11 others were recaptured. The various incidents started after the Cubans learned about a new agreement between the governments in Washington and Havana that could mean deportation for the detainees. The Cubans say they don't want to go back. A last-minute push to work out final details of a proposed intermediate-range missile treaty got underway today in Geneva. Secretary of State George Shultz and Soviet Foreign Minister Eduard Shevardnadze began 3 days of talks under intense pressure to finish that treaty in time for a planned summit conference next month between President Reagan and Soviet leader Gorbachev. The pact is tentatively scheduled to be signed in Washington on December 9th. Gorbachev has agreed to an unrehearsed television interview with NBC News anchor Tom Brokaw. The hour-long interview will be recorded in Moscow next Sunday for broadcast the next night at 8 p.m. Eastern Time. Frank Carlucci was sworn in today as the Secretary of Defense. The former National Security Advisor succeeds Caspar Weinberger, who resigned for personal reasons. At today's ceremony, Carlucci praised Weinberger for building America's military strength.
I'm proud to say, Mr. President, that I have played some small role in achieving that goal, because surely, as you said the other day, Cap will go down in history as our finest Secretary of Defense. And Cap, I will try to carry on in your tradition.
Carlucci holds his first official news conference tomorrow. The Pentagon said today the Navy destroyed 2 more mines in a Persian Gulf shipping lane yesterday. That brings the total of mines to 9 in the past 4 days. Shipping sources say an Iranian frigate today shelled 2 freighters bound for Kuwait and Saudi Arabia. More from the BBC's Jim Muir.
Both the ships were on their way into the Gulf and were bound for Arab ports there when they were intercepted by the Iranians while passing through the Strait of Hormuz at the Gulf's southern entry. The first to be hit was a Taiwanese-owned container ship, the Unimaster, flying the Panamanian flag. It was struck by a number of projectiles believed to be rocket-propelled grenades, which started a fire on the vessel's deck and in one of its containers. Much worse damaged, by all accounts, was the Romanian flag carrier, the Fundulea, which was hit nearby a short while later, apparently by an Iranian frigate which had just intercepted the vessel and established its identity and destination, which was Kuwait. These latest attacks brought to 4 the number of vessels hit by the Iranians in the past 3 days. The attacks, which are rarely announced by the Iranians themselves, are believed to be in retaliation for the recent spate of Iraqi airstrikes on tankers and other vessels off the Iranian coast.
The BBC's Jim Muir. World monetary markets had little reaction today to the U.S. deficit reduction plan. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 9 points to close at 1,923, and that was in moderate trading. I'm Mark Boardman for National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Our jazz critic Kevin Whitehead has a review of some previously uncollected recordings by the late tenor saxophonist Ike Quebec.
American tavern culture has had some grand traditions now all but vanished. The free lunch, the cheap draft beer, the bartender's buyback round, and a jukebox stuffed with jazz 45s. By the late 1950s, long-playing records had become standard, but some labels still released a few jazz singles, modern offspring of the old 3-minute 78s. Some of the last jazz recorded specifically for the jukebox trade has been collected on the complete Blue Note 45 sessions of Ike Quebec, a 3-LP set on the mail-order label Mosaic. I'll give you their address in a minute. Tenor saxophonist Ike Quebec had gone unrecorded for 6 years before he made the first of 3 sessions heard here. Taped in 1959, 60, and 62, all 3 dates involved small groups with an organ player, either Edwin Swanston, Sir Charles Thompson, or Earl Van Dyke. The classic organ combo plays soulful, no-frills jazz, which has never enjoyed much critical praise. Partly that's because organ groups flourished almost exclusively in noisy saloons, but also because electric organs' gurgling chords and muddy bass lines usually sound so cheesy. But organ combos, which echo the music of the Black Church, can create stark backdrops for a testifying tenor saxophone. If bartenders minister to the soul, Ike Quebec's emotive blues and standards must have been perfect accompaniment to evening services, a point reinforced by titles like Zonkey, Buzzard Lope, and Dear John. His Blue Monday, with Skeeter Best on guitar, is music for folks who see the world through the bottom of a gin glass. Ike Quebec had reasons to be blue himself. He died of cancer at age 44, a year after the last of these sessions. But there's nothing self-pitying about his art, and his solos stand up quite well in the daylight of sober analysis. You can, if you wish, note his excellent ear, abiding respect for melody, variety of singing attacks, and his rhythmically persuasive gestural simplicity. But you don't think about high-tone stuff like that when Ike Quebec is playing. Here he is on the Gershwins' How Long Has This Been Going On? Thank you. Mosaic Records' 3-LP set of Ike Quebec's Blue Note 45s, almost half of which appear here for the first time, is a typically classy Mosaic box. Extensive liner notes and a discography put the music in historical context, and the vinyl is as quiet as vinyl gets. Again, Mosaic Records are available only by mail. They're at 197 Strawberry Hill Avenue, Stamford, Connecticut, 06902. Such a meticulous reissue of lowly gin mill music implies that jazz fans, like film scholars, have learned not to dismiss any genre as worthless, but to look for the good work done within it. On his organ combo 45s, Ike Quebec's majestic sound transcends both the settings in which he recorded and the settings in which he was apt to be heard.
Kevin Whitehead is a regular contributor to Downbeat Cadence and Jazz Times. He reviewed the complete Blue Note 45 sessions of Ike Quebec. They're collected on the mail order label Mosaic Records, located at 197 Strawberry Hill Avenue, Stamford, Connecticut, 06902. You're listening to Fresh Air. Wayne Wang's new film Slam Dance is a stylized thriller centered around the Los Angeles art and club scenes. The film is a departure for the Asian-American director whose other features, Chan Is Missing and Dim Sum, were set in the Asian community of San Francisco. Slam Dance was written by my guest, Don Opper. Opper is also an actor and appears in the film as a tormented thug named Buddy. He co-stars with Tom Hulse, Mary Elizabeth Mastrantonio, and rock musicians Adam Ant and John Doe. The script is filled with twists and turns, but here's how Opper describes the basic story.
Slam Dance is about a underground artist or underground cartoonist who gets involved in a murder. He's a man that's separated from his wife. He had a relationship with a woman, and it's the story's about unraveling the mystery of who killed her and why.
Is this on some level based on any problems you were having at the time you wrote it?
I wouldn't say in the particulars, but I think in thematically, I think it dealt with some things that were personal, yeah.
Do you want to say what, or would you rather not?
I think, you know, a lot of people have marital problems, a lot of people have affairs, and I don't think, usually in real life, we don't have the convenient murder, to get us out of it. So I would say, you know, thematically it has to do with a guy taking responsibility for what he does. I think that's a personal thing. But certainly I wasn't involved in a murder. I wasn't a suspect in a murder.
In the ads for Slam Dance, the ad copy makes a point of saying that this is not a film about dancing. Do you want to describe what slam dancing is and why you gave the film that title?
Slam dancing was, I think, the early 80s, late 70s, early 80s, was a kind of dancing. It was a punk dancing that people ran into each other and tried to knock each other down, and it was kind of organized chaos. And the reason I used it is the title of the movie was, if you are on the dance floor, you're going to get knocked down, whether you know what's going on. If you don't know, for instance, if you don't know what's going on, you walk in the middle of the dance floor, you're going to get knocked down. So I thought that was a pretty good metaphor for what happens to the central character of the script.
You're one of the co-stars in the film. You play a kind of existential bad guy.
Yeah.
Real offbeat bad guy. Did you write that role with yourself in mind?
No, I didn't. I actually, the role I wrote with myself in mind was Drood.
The lead character.
Yeah, but Buddy was my favorite character in the script, and I didn't have any intention of playing it. It was written for a much bigger person, more classic thug-like person. I don't remember exactly at what point we decided it was decided I was going to do it, but it was fairly close to the time we started filming.
You said you initially envisioned the thug that you play as a bigger, more muscular guy than you are. You're kind of medium height, pretty slender. Mm-hmm. What did you do to yourself to get more of a toughened image?
Well, I didn't do too much. I gained 10 pounds, which was a tremendous struggle. I changed a little bit of my look by wearing a hairpiece.
That's a hairpiece, huh?
Well, part of it is, yeah.
Uh-huh.
Part of it is me. I changed my hair color. I mean, I'm not the kind of person who can all of a sudden look 6 feet two and weigh 260 pounds. So it was a matter of adjusting. There was a little bit of adjusting in the script to make me a little bit more menacing script-wise, because my immediate physical presence might not have carried that. So we adjusted the script a little bit to carry that a little more.
Are there any difficulties involved with acting in your own screenplay? I'm thinking, for instance, maybe there's this constant temptation to rewrite each scene as you're acting in it.
No, there's. I don't think there's. There's. It's two different functions. You write the film. You write a film, and then if you've given the film over to a director, the director's in charge. And then as an actor, every actor has a tendency to try to rewrite anything. To try to get the words out of his mouth in a better way. Those are the best reasons. Some actors have bad reasons to change dialogue. They don't want to say certain words, or they don't think it makes them look good. But any actor has a tendency to try to collaborate with the director and the writer, if possible, and work on a scene. Happily for me, it's two separate functions. And basically, I become an actor 2 weeks before a film starts. And when I'm in a scene, it's between me and the director, and I'm at his mercy, basically.
Did you go to film school?
No, I didn't. I didn't go to any school.
Is it hard to break in when you haven't gone to film school?
I don't know. That's like a relative question. I don't know if it's any harder to break in if you've gone to film school or not. I started working in the industry just to make money, not as a writer. I started as a grip, and then I became a carpenter, and I've done just about all the crafts. I've worked in various capacities on films for Roger Corman. So I've been a driver, I've been a production assistant, I've been assistant director on one of his films. So my coming into it was from a very strange kind of, I came from the bottom. And I always liked it. I sort of liked working that way.
Working with Roger Corman, you probably learned how to make movies fast and cheap.
We learned a certain method. There's a certain method a lot of people, I think if I went to school, that was the school I went to. You know, I think it's better than going to film school, is to work. And I've felt that way just about anything I've done. So it's a great place to learn.
Which of his movies did you work on?
The first movie I worked on for him was Battle Beyond the Stars.
Did John Sayles write that one?
I don't remember. I mean, it was like, I always liken that experience to being in Vietnam.
How was it like being in Vietnam?
It was hell. It was hell.
In what way?
Oh, God. He had just moved into a studio in Venice, and the place flooded during the course of... It was like slogging through hell to be on that film. Incredibly long hours, and the place was flooded, and you know, you were walking in knee-deep water, and it was just horrible. It was I don't know how to explain it. It was just like a horrible experience, except that I stuck with it, and I learned a lot. I met a lot of people and had a good time, as a matter of fact.
I guess that's what you call paying your dues.
Well, I'm still paying dues. You never get there. You always think that you've made it, and then the next thing is, no, I've got to do something else. So,
well, you know, it's a funny thing. I really liked your movie very much, but I've noticed it just closed in Philadelphia, and it wasn't here all that long. What are some of the problems that you have with a movie like Slam Dance getting it screened around the country?
Well, the movie has some problems as far as being a commercial movie. I think it's an interesting movie. To get a movie like... I think that... I don't know. I don't know what the answer to this is. This is a tough question. It's got to be marketed correctly. I don't know if that's going to change anything. I think that has to... You know, it has to come out at the right time. Slam Dance came out at a time when there were a lot of films sort of about similar... in the same area. I don't know if you... You know, No Way Out... oh, God. A Fatal Attraction. You know what I'm saying? So, sort of noirish kind of looks at the world. Slam Dance looks different than any of those, but I don't know. It's a mystery. Anybody who can say how to market a movie and this will be a certain success is lying, I think.
Okay. Well, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Yeah, thank you.
Don Opper wrote and co-stars in the new film Slam Dance. He spoke to us from the NPR studios in Los Angeles. This is Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of today's news on All Things Considered. Robert Siegel co-hosts the program, and he's joining us from Washington. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry.
What stories are you following?
Well, we're following the prison riots, not just in Louisiana now, but also in Atlanta, Georgia, which seem to be linked to the announcement of a new immigration agreement between the United States and Cuba and what the two have to do with each other. We also have a report on the Schultz-Shevardnadze meeting in Europe and also a report on campaigning with Vice President George Bush. Linda Wertheimer brings back the standard Bush stump speech. For us. Also, a story about using focus groups to prepare people in this country for the summit, the uses of focus groups, and whether this is a good one.
Thanks, Robert. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Imagine a radio shock jock hosting a public affairs TV show. Our television critic David Bianculli says that will give you an idea of what the Morton Downey Jr. show is like.
It seems there's a new TV talk show born every week, which may have something to do with that idea of a sucker being born every minute. There's one new talk show, though, that stands out. It stands out like a sore thumb, even though a sore thumb would be more entertaining. It's called The Morton Downey Jr. Show, and it's now in its second month on New Jersey's WWOR. That station's signal is distributed nationally via satellite to most cable TV systems, so most of you are within Downey's electronic reach. It's not a pretty thought. Downey is from that tradition of screaming conservative TV hosts whose legacy goes back to Joe Pine in the 60s. Downey, in fact, uses most of Pine's old tricks. He smokes incessantly, he paces, and he shouts a lot. Sometimes he shouts at his guest. Sometimes, just before the final credits roll, he throws them off the set for effect. Downey's guests range from members of Planned Parenthood to members of the Jewish Defense League. But the key to his show is the studio audience he invites. The people who attend tapings of the Morton Downey Jr. show are like the Transylvanians who stormed Frankenstein's castle, and Downey is carrying the lead torch. Every show has that frenzied, hostile atmosphere of a lynching, and it's a mood Downey encourages. It's like TV wrestling or the Gong Show, except that Downey has podium set up so that members of the audience can step up and take their best shots. The results are appalling. Recently, when an imperial wizard of a Ku Klux Klan splinter group was Downey's guest, one audience member tried his best to make the Klansman look silly. This shouldn't have been too difficult, but the guy couldn't do it until he got help from another audience member. Listen to the tone of these exchanges.
You, sir.
Yeah, the Constitution says all men are created equal.
It does not.
All right, shut up and let me finish, you moron.
It does not.
The what? Bible says...
Have you ever read neighbor? The Constitution of the United States, moron? You are a moron. You're talking about our Constitution, and you have not read it.
You are talking to my son, and he is not a moron.
This level of articulate discussion is set by Downey's own example. When audience members heckle his guests, Downey says nothing. If they dare to heckle him, though, he's prepared with his foolproof barrage of comebacks. His favorite line is shut up. But when that doesn't get results, he's ready with others. He says zip it a lot. And sometimes he says things I don't feel comfortable repeating. Downey's guests get the same treatment from him as his hecklers. Here's an example from a show in which the guest was presidential candidate Lyndon LaRouche.
I don't have any companies. I don't have anything.
You don't have New Solidarity? That's not part of your organization.
I don't control
it. You're a liar.
No, I don't.
You're a liar. I've been down to your organization. I've met your people. I've talked with all of them. And do you know, sir, that you selected me in 1985 as the Journalist of the Year?
But I
got that piece of crap award from your fascist group.
The temptation here, and it's almost overwhelming, is to play Downey's own game, to throw insults, make fun of him, and give him a taste of his own vile medicine. I'm genuinely afraid, though, that Downey shouldn't be dismissed so easily. As a showman, he knows precisely what he's doing, and his show works because it allows each audience member, and vicariously each TV viewer, to slip into the role of the bully. It's not an audience, it's a mob.
We don't want you. Do we want him out?
Yeah!
Go! 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 Go!
David Bianculli is television critic for the New York Post. Here's a look at tomorrow's Fresh Air. Tomorrow, I'll speak with Japanese poet Nanao Sakaki, a leading voice of Japan's counterculture. His poetry has been championed by American poets like Gary Snyder, Allen Ginsberg, and Robert Bly. Also, rock historian Ed Ward will profile the late Bobby Fuller, the West Texas rocker who is best remembered for his hit I Fought the Law. And book critic John Leonard will review The Redemption of Elsden Bird, the debut novel of Noel Virtue. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton are the production assistants. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.